right, my name is Melissa Thomason. Oh, is it? There we go. I have no disclosures, except that I am brutally honest and infinitely passionate. Okay. All right, so this is kind of how it went. That video that was like, and I saw the trees and they were more beautiful and life was grand. I really thought that I'd kind of like paid my price for the hell life can dish at you, right? Like there's obviously a bar, and once you reach that bar, the universe won't send you anymore. That's what I thought, right? So I went home and I thought, I'm going to be okay now. And I got through this great trial, and really that was just the beginning. So at the end of that video, when it's all peaceful and beautiful, that was shot by the hospital and that I work with locally, and they really just wanted to film the piece that happened at their hospital. 6 months after that, I was diagnosed with, I had a huge aneurysm in the top of my descending aorta. They diagnosed me with Loeys Dietz syndrome. It's okay if you've never heard of it. Basically, none of my doctors ever had either. It's a rare connective tissue disorder. It's like Marfan's, but I like to say it's its angry, ugly cousin, the one you don't invite to Thanksgiving dinner, because it can wreck your whole arterial tree, not just your aorta, and we dissect at much smaller sizes. So I was diagnosed with Loeys Dietz. They found this huge aneurysm, and I was scared to death that I was going to have another heart surgery because it took me forever to get back on my feet after the first one. Of course, I did have a C-section that same day, so I'm still proud of myself that I did a good job recovering. Okay, so I was terrified I was going to have another heart surgery. And I go to Duke, and I find out I have to have two more huge surgeries within the next couple of months. So 9 months after that first open heart, they did a huge thoracoabdominal incision and replaced my entire descending aorta. And that cardiothoracic surgeon looked at me and he said, Melissa, I know you've had heart surgery before, but this one's going to make that one look like a walk in the park. And I said, you obviously have never had open heart surgery because that can't look like a walk in the park. And then it did. That thoracoabdominal incision was the most pain I have ever experienced in my life. I came home and still on heavy pain meds would just shake and would stare at my mom and look in her eyes for hours to try to not lose my mind because the pain was so intense. And then as soon as I got back on my feet 3 months later, they did another one. They went in, they did a David 5 procedure. They replaced my aortic root and went from there. So I did 3 open hearts in a year, 6 procedures in 18 months. That second surgery severed the nerve to my left vocal cord. So I couldn't speak above a whisper for basically a year. It was literally the best year of my husband's life. Really, I'm still reminded of those days. And after I got it all done, I really thought, okay, whew, I actually shot a video of me the very last day at Duke, and I tell myself, I am so proud of you. You lived. And what an amazing thing that is, because I promise you, there were days when it would have been easier to die. God knew, the universe knew what he was doing when he gave me that baby, at the same time that he let me discover this genetic disorder. Because there were days that I literally only got out of bed because I knew that he would do something new that day. It didn't seem worth it to keep going on. But Nate was going to learn to walk soon, and I wanted to see that. And then after I saw him walk, it was, but Nate's going to learn to do this soon, and I want to see that. And but my husband grew up playing basketball, and my kid needs to play baseball, and I've got to be here to make sure he knows how to throw a ball. Right? It didn't matter what it was. I found a new goal every single day that I could live toward and for. And I did, and I was super proud of myself, and I thought that was it. And then everything was over, and the nightmare started. And I would wake up screaming in the middle of the night, and I had no idea why. And I had really intense PTSD. And I would dream about doctors cutting me open and replacing parts and not using anesthesia and waking up during surgeries and things like that. And it was awful. And I had to find a way to heal. And I really didn't know how until someone from the local hospital contacted me. And she said, Melissa, I heard your story and I think it's amazing. Have you ever considered telling it or becoming a patient advocate or an advisor? And I said, no, but let's give it a shot, right? I was a former public school teacher. I'd been a youth minister. I'm not afraid of, I can talk to 2,000 people as easily as I can talk to two, right? Sure, let's try it. And I knew that I went in there, honestly, to help healthcare be better, right? I had an incredible experience, my first open heart surgery, but I had some really scary nights too. Nights when medical errors almost killed me. And I wanted to make sure that we did something about those. So I went in to help healthcare. Healthcare kind of helped me too, though. Sharing my story helped me heal. Sharing my story helped me find a purpose in all of that pain. And I became a patient family advisor and a professional advocate, and I have been one ever since. So why am I up here today? I want to talk about technicians versus teachers, building a culture of engagement with your patients, and why we should even care about this work now more than ever. I want you to stop and ask yourself, are you a technician or a teacher? And that's in whatever job you do. If you're an administrator, if you're a clinician, if you're a student, what do you want to be? Are you a technician or are you a teacher? Take a minute for self-reflection. All right, and let's talk about it. So this was my favorite technician or teacher quote that I found, and I loved it, and I despise when people read directly from presentations, but I do not want to mess this girl's quote up. So she says, as I look at the entering classes below me, my peers and even those residents and young attendings ahead of me, I find fewer and fewer people who exemplify the characteristics of both a successful physician and a true student of the human condition. We have virtually unlimited access to the most intimate and pivotal moments in the lives of essentially complete strangers. We get to witness the beginnings and ends of lives, the receipt of life-changing news, and the long-term trajectories of both slow recovery and rapid decline. We should, perhaps even more so than sociologists, psychologists, and anthropologists, be the ultimate scholars of humanity. Yet doctors, and residents in particular, are so overworked that they rarely stop to observe the world they exist in, to reflect on it, and to share their reflections with others, or even just with themselves. That kind of encapsulates the whole teacher or technician, right? When you think of technicians, you think scientific, cold, measured, sterile. We think of teacher, you think of engaged, passionate, do whatever it takes to change a kid's life. And the bridge between those two really is patient and family engagement and teaching your patients how to engage so that they can become more activated. You guys all know about patient engagement. It's been a buzzword for a million years. And what does it really mean? It's just an active partnership with your patients. A lot of healthcare workers are incredible with what they do for patients. But it really is a day and time now that it's about what you do with your patients as well. So this is my favorite model for patient engagement. It's the multidimensional framework. It was in Health Affairs a few years ago, and I worked with Maureen Marr, who did an incredible job with this, her and her team. And they had a whole team of advocates that built this. And it talks about engagement basically from the bedside to the boardroom. It talks about direct care, but then it also talks about organizational care and policy making and things like that. How many of you are clinicians who deliver direct care? Wowza! How many of you are residents? How about support staff as far as local direct care facilities? Just a few. Awesome. So we have a lot of clinicians here. Fantastic. You guys can't. Sorry, this is who I am. Okay. I apologize daily to my husband. It just kind of is. All right. So how do we build a culture of engagement in these direct care clinics? How do we engage our patients? Well, the first thing, I think we have to cultivate compassion. All right, I have plenty of time left. I think we have to cultivate compassion. We talk a lot about empathy. I'm a fan of empathy, absolutely. But I don't think empathy's the end goal. Empathy's the gateway to compassion. I love how Lori Chandler says it. from The Big Think. She says, empathy is the gateway to compassion. It's understanding how someone feels and trying to imagine how that might feel for you, a mode of relating. Compassion takes it further. It's feeling what that person is feeling, holding it, accepting it, and taking some kind of action. Okay, so I want you to start to think about, yes, empathy is an emotion, absolutely. But empathy can be cultivated intellectually as well. Challenge yourself and your staff to put themselves in the shoes of your patients. As bombarded as you are by your schedules, by everything expected of you, I think physicians and healthcare providers have some of the hardest jobs in the world. I could not do it. I do not pretend that I can't, that I could or that I can. But amidst it all, the key to it really is putting yourself in someone else's shoes. And then, once you've done that, to challenge yourself to take action on their behalf. Compassion, I like to tell people, is super important that you realize compassion's not a binary concept. When I was in the hospital, like my second surgery, I had a nurse that I was in ICU. I was intubated. I woke up, and they wouldn't let my family back. Okay, family presence guidelines at that hospital were super strict. They wouldn't let my family back at all. It was 2 or 3 a.m., and I woke up, and I was asking her, as soon as I wake up, she goes, "Hello, the surgery went well. Your family came. You were asleep. You will see them in the morning." And, you know, for someone who's just undergone heart surgery, all I wanted to see in the whole world was my husband. And I said, okay, I can do this. But I was in a ton of pain after that thoracoabdominal procedure. And I hear her tell another nurse, you know, she's already on Dilaudid, but if they put her on fentanyl on top of it, maybe it'll work, right? Well, my heart dropped through the floor. Because at the last hospital with my last surgery, I had already been on huge amounts of Dilaudid, and they put a fentanyl patch on top of it, and it almost killed me. And that was a horrible night. My blood pressure bottomed out. I was unconscious for a while. It literally almost killed me. So I'm lying in an ICU. I'm intubated. I hear a nurse say that she's going to do something dangerous, I think, for me. And I can't do a thing in the world about it. So I try to use sign. I only know my alphabet as far as sign language, but I try to start signing to her, no fentanyl. Like, I can't have that fentanyl patch. No, it's type A control while you're in ICU. Do you get this? Right? I know you guys know, you're physicians. Don't act like you wouldn't be trying to run your own care from the ICU. Okay? All right. So I'm signing, no fentanyl. And she says, I do not know sign language, walks away. And it hits me, oh my God, I'm going to die in the ICU, right? I survived an aortic dissection, and now they're going to kill me in the ICU. So I get really upset, and I start crying and choking on the tube. And she comes back over, and she's like, what is it? And I started signing again, no fentanyl. And she said, I told you I don't know sign language, girl. And then I just knew, okay, well, I can't do anything. I started choking on the tube and crying, and she finally wrote all the letters down on a page and sort of held it up aggressively in front of me. And she said, drag your hand. Tell me what you're trying to say. And I knew that I could not drag my swollen hand across that paper and be like, look, when I was at the last hospital, they gave me a fentanyl patch, and it was on top of Dilaudid, and you need to make sure it's not a patch, and, right, wasn't going to happen. So what did I do? I drug my finger to H-U-S-B, and she said, husband? Are you trying to say husband? And I said, yeah, because I knew that if he was in there, he would not let anyone hurt me. Family presence is about more than socializing. Family presence is about safety. No one knows me better than my family that have walked me through this whole trip. So she says, are you trying to say husband? And I shook my head, and she said, I told you it's not visiting hours. And finally, I cried so hard that she couldn't help but call him. And she called him in, and he walks in, and he says, baby, what's wrong? And I was crying, and I signed, "No fentanyl, please." And he knows his letters too, and he looked at her and he said, "Who's trying to give her fentanyl? She can't have fentanyl on top of that Dilaudid." And that nurse said, "Well, not me." And I was like, okay, when I can talk again, it's going down, right? Okay. So that is at one end of the compassion spectrum. Yes, I won't call her name, but I know it. Okay. At one end of the compassion spectrum. At the other end of the compassion spectrum is one of my favorite nurses of all time, Penny Pillow Top Mattress Girl. I love her. First surgery, I realized that they were supposed to let me go home. I developed all these other issues. I realized I wasn't going home. Man, I just fell all to pieces. I was crying. I wasn't going to get to go home with my baby yet. I couldn't take that stupid hospital bed anymore. My back was killing me. And she said, "Let's do this." She took all the pillows that they had extra on the floor, stuffed them under the bottom sheet of the hospital bed, put me in the bed, and rubbed my feet until I fell asleep. And I was okay after that. I made it 4 more weeks. But she knew that I had literally all I could take. And she went the extra mile because she knew that it must be hard for me. She went beyond empathy. She took action. She was a compassionate person. And to me, she's on the other end of compassion. Most of us live somewhere in between Penny Pillow Top Mattress and that girl, right? So I need you to wake up every day and say, can I move further along the spectrum of compassion, right? Because a lot of times we just see ourselves as compassionate individuals and we say, yeah, I'm compassionate. It's not a yes or no question. Can you be more compassionate? Can you do more? Can your staff do more? Can your patients even be more compassionate about? It really is about developing a culture of compassion in your facilities. Compassion's contagious. One of my favorite brain games episodes. How many of you like TED Talks and brain games and things like that? I have a 9-year-old son now. He's obsessed with brain games. And one of my favorites is one that shows genuinely compassion is contagious. When people are shown compassion, they are more likely to show it, right? So it reach one, teach one, and then it spreads. Communication. If you're going to build a culture of engagement, you've got to communicate. Listen without interrupting and without technological barriers. If there is a computer screen between you and your patient, it's not okay. I want to see my doctor's screen, I want to see his face, and I want to be able to talk to him. I want you to be mindful of nonverbal cues. If you walk in and say, "Hey, how you doing? You got any questions? All righty," and go to walk away, I already know. You may be saying, "Do you have any questions?" But what you're really saying is, "I don't have time for your questions today. Could you please hold them?" Right? So watch your nonverbal cues. And then be conscious to speak like you care. Yep. I want you to talk like you care to your patients. But I want you to do it because you do. People get it. Just like I said in the video, I can teach you to talk like you care, to walk like you care. I can give you keywords. I can make it look like you care all day long. But really, you probably went into this work because you did. Reconnect with that care, that compassion in you, why you went into this work in the first place. And because you care, talk like you care. Speak up for your patients. Collaboration. I'm a huge fan of collaboration, not just with your patients, but with whoever it takes, whenever it takes it. Other professionals, hospitals, interprofessional teams and appointments. I believe deeply in shared decision making. If you're going to have a culture of engagement, if you're going to bridge the gap in your facility between being a technician and a teacher. Shared decision making, as you know, is just us deciding together what's best for me. And family presence, like I told you, is huge. Now, family presence in a hospital, yes, it matters. But I think it matters in a direct care clinic as well. So my dad was just recently, it's been almost 2 years. My dad was diagnosed with MSA. It's multiple system atrophy, and it closely mirrors ALS. It is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. All of those heart surgeries don't touch the surface of watching my daddy be trapped in his body like a prisoner. He started off at his primary care physician. We had no idea what was going on. He was having all these symptoms. He wasn't safe in his job anymore. He was falling off ladders. And I asked Dad, I said, Dad, can I go to your next appointment with you? And he said, well, honey, I don't know if you're allowed to do that. Right? And I said, oh, yes, I am. Yes, I am. I bet you I am. And he says, okay. We went to the next appointment. I requested a referral to Duke's movement disorder clinic. We had a diagnosis within 2 weeks, right? There are key learners in families. There are people who can, caretakers in family, the people who get stuff done. Invite those families into your offices. My mom takes her medicine because of me. I go to every appointment with her. My dad got a diagnosis because of me. And I lived through all of that because of you guys and because of them. I went home with my mom. I went home with my husband. And when the rubber meets the road at home, families are the ones that the burden of health care falls on. We know that a tremendous percentage of the health of a patient comes from things that don't happen in your office. So if you're gonna touch their home life, you gotta touch their families. Coordination, navigation. Here's something I don't think we think about a lot. When you've got to think about how your patients see the world, if you're really gonna talk to a patient and that patient's going to understand you, connect with you, engage with you, trust you, then sometimes you've gotta take off your healthcare hat and embrace the darkness, right? Don't embrace the darkness like bad stuff, guys. Don't do that, right? I mean darkness like before the light came on and you knew how to navigate the system. I was intelligent, got a full scholarship to college, majored in biology, thought I would go to med school, volunteered in the hospital, hated it, totally hated it, said no way I want to be a doctor, ended up becoming a teacher. I knew a lot when I got sick. Dude, I was so lost. I had no clue. The night they overdosed me, I had an RN to my best friend. And she said, Melissa, why didn't Will go get the charge nurse? And I said, what is a charge nurse? And she realized, really, I had no idea. When my dad said, I don't think you're allowed to come to the appointment. We don't know how it works in your world. I don't speak doctor. Take off your healthcare hat. Do the best you can to embrace the darkness of not knowing it. Put yourself in your patient's shoes and then actively help them navigate those landmines and potholes that they're going to come upon as they walk through this road of sickness. And then last, because it's STFM, educate. So, like I said, I'm a former teacher. Education matters to me. But I don't think teaching is just the job of teachers. I do lots of rounds and things like that in my local facility. I've rounded all over the country with direct care clinics. They'll fly me in, and I'll do lots of rounds and look and see, okay, this is what we need to do. And a lot of times what I see can be handled by education, mostly. So I saw a teacher one night at one of the rounds, or I saw a nurse one night, one of the rounds. And I asked him, we were having a conversation, I said, how can we empower you to engage your patients? And he said, well, I think we need more time, we need this, we need that. And I said, yeah, so that you can teach them how to. And he says, stop. I am a nurse, not a teacher. By the way, guys, if you're a physician, you're a teacher. If you're a nurse, you're a teacher. If you're a resident, you're a teacher. If you're in the office setting, you are a teacher. And I don't care if you embrace the role, you're still one. And it doesn't matter if you're actively teaching or not actively teaching. You're teaching. They are learning something about care and about life and about their own value and about their meds and about their walk in this thing from you. They're learning from you. The question is, are they learning what they should be learning, right? So embrace the apple. Become a teacher in your facilities. And then to a little pun on that one, embrace technology, like that Apple iPad and that Apple iPhone or your Android or whatever it takes to connect with your patients outside of the office too. Include caretakers and key learners in education sessions. One of the small groups I went to yesterday, they had staff educators. Love it. Love it. If we're going to move the needle on American healthcare, we've got to teach Americans about healthcare. Empower patients to engage in their care. Make learning a part of your culture. Learn while you listen. Right? So, way back to that quote when it says, physicians see humanity more than almost all professions. While you go through your day, what are you learning? What do you learn about the patient experience? And then share that. Teach while you talk. Don't just say, I got to talk to a patient. Or think of it like that. I got to talk to a patient. I got to speak to him. Right? You are teaching him all the time. And just be conscious of it. Be creative. Do whatever it takes to make sure you touch base with him and he understands things when he leaves your office. One of my favorite doctors, my pulmonologist, they put me on it. I carry a little oxygen concentrator around. They put me on it this past summer. And I was like, but wait a minute. Why do I need oxygen if? And he got the little diagram out. And he's like, Melissa, your lung is like a sponge. And because you have all of this scar tissue, it's pushing down the sponge. And basically, your whole left, and he goes through this whole spiel about how important it is for me to wear my oxygen. And because I understood, now you don't have to tell me to wear my oxygen. I know I should wear my oxygen if I'm exerting myself or walking long distances or things like that. He taught me, and he changed my life. He literally changed how I live my life. And then we're talking about engaging patients bedside to boardroom. How many of you have patient advisory councils in your facilities? How many of you have amazing patient advisory councils? Four of you. No, just kidding. All right. So, patient advisory councils, again, they exist on a spectrum. I've been at conferences where patient advisors basically just help pick out the wall color or the curtains, right? Okay. That's not necessarily what I'm talking about. I'm talking about engaging with patients for organizational level. I mean, I'm talking about stuff like this, right? All of that I have done as a patient family advisor, either in my local clinic or my local hospital. I've done literature review. I've helped design curriculums for education. I've worked in safety. I've done RCAs. We've done rounding. And I tell you what, a patient will open up to a patient advisor or a fellow patient a lot of times, much more quickly than they open up to someone in a white coat or someone in a business suit. We walked in, my first experience with patient rounding, I walked into the heart center, into a room with the, she's a CEO there, she runs the whole heart center. And she asked a male, probably early 20s, she said, how's your stay going? He said, fine. And she said, is there anything that we could do better? He said, no. Right? Didn't get any feedback whatsoever. So I stepped up and I was like, hey, my name's Melissa, and I have a zipper scar just like you because I was in this place not too long ago, and he totally changed. And he looked at me and said, does it get better? Does the pain stop? And I said, yeah, man, I know it feels like it's not going to, but you got to sleep and you got to eat and you got to walk like those nurses say. I said, now, is there anything that we can do better? And he said, I'll make you a list, right? And there was a lot we could be doing better. He just wasn't comfortable opening up to, someone in a business suit or someone in a white coat. You can use patient advisory councils to do stuff like that. We've helped design facilities, and I've worked on performance improvement teams. I did one unit we specifically looked at. They had their central line infections spiked. They wanted to know why they were spiking, so we did an FMEA, and guess what they thought? That the very first day that we sat down at the table, they concluded before ever doing the math of the FMEA that the reason the central lines in that unit, the central line infections in that unit had spiked was because, who do you think they blamed? Patients and families, right? So they said, well, obviously it's because we're letting all these people back and we have all these family presence things and there's more germs and we have more central line infections. And if there had not been a patient at that table, that would have been their conclusion. And we would not have moved the needle. But I was at that table, and I said, don't you have a central line infection increase over the last year? Didn't we change family presence guidelines 7 years ago? And they said, oh, let's do number one, right? Because then they figured out. Having a patient at the table changes the conversation. They're not always going to be right. They're not always going to be wrong. The point is, they have something to say, and so do you. And if you don't do it in a partnership, you are missing one of the key stakeholders in what you do. Unit-based work and storytelling is enormous, obviously. People remember how you make them feel. And stories inspire emotion and move needles, right? So they start at our local hospital, they start every morning with a patient story. Every morning with a huddle, right? Inspire yourself. Actively cultivate storytelling, empathy, compassion. And then the other things, measures and research, yes. Patients can certainly, and patient advocates can certainly work on measure groups. I've done a lot with star rating systems. I presented at a conference a couple years ago on how we developed star rating system for CMS with patient input and things like that. Research, there's a huge area open in research, and we need more patients in that field. And then, because of the world we live in, man, there's a lot of room for patients in policy. Are our lawmakers patient enough? A lot of times, and I've heard it said a million times, oh, we have a patient advisor. She's also a nurse. Okay. I'm not saying that she didn't have an incredible patient experience. Yes, if she fought cancer or if she had heart surgery or if her husband got sick, her experience is just as valid as any other patient. But she cannot know what it's like to be that vulnerable and that afraid and not have the knowledge of the healthcare system. So I'm not just talking about healthcare workers with patient experience. I am talking about real patients, sometimes chronically ill, that know what it's like to have to figure out meds and to coordinate oxygen, and because the airplane won't add a daggone outlet on it, right, for the oxygen concentrator. That's just my soapbox, okay. Right, what it's like to have to coordinate the logistics of being sick. You can't teach that, and patients can help you understand it. Now, I think there should be real patients at every decision-making table about healthcare in the country, particularly in Washington, D.C. I did a spoken word poem last time I was at the PCPCC conference. I had 10 minutes. Marcy said, you have 10 minutes. And I was like, okay. It was 2 days after, no, maybe the next day, 2 days? 2 days after President Trump was elected. You can imagine what that poem looked like, right? Okay, 2 days after President Trump was elected. And we had no idea where healthcare was going. And I did a spoken word poem called The Impatient Patient, right? If you are chronically ill, you can be full of empathy. You can be full of compassion. You can be full of intelligence and fire and want. What you're not full of is time, okay? I don't get to choose to be sick or not. I didn't get a vote about whether I would be sick or not, right? I just was born that way. And we need real people at decision-making tables in D.C. and around the country telling people what it's like to live that life every day so that they understand we are more than numbers on a paper. It is someone's life. It is their moments that you are playing with. It is children's birthdays and weddings and invitations to travel around the world that you are messing with when you mess with healthcare. Set a place for patients at the table. If you're at the table, if you were invited to the table, and you are a champion for patients, speak up and say, where is the real patient in this room? And if there isn't one, advocate for there to be. And when they come in that room, hey, they may not know at first all about what goes on in that room. Take them under your wing. Frame it for them. Tell them what to expect and help them learn to really engage in the system. Caretakers for Congress, right? So you guys have some of the hardest jobs in the world, but I kind of want you to make them a little bit harder. I would love to see you take what you know and be broader with it. I would love to see more doctors take an active role in politics or community development. My doctors are some of the pillars of my community. They have so much on their plate. It would certainly take some logistical restructuring, but embrace the role you've been given. People trust you. What you say matters. Recognize that and use that platform. Now, I ask you again, are you a technician or are you a teacher? This picture was taken in ICU, that first surgery. My husband went to the nurse, the head nurse, because we didn't know to call her a charge nurse then, right? The head nurse, and he said, can I please bring the baby in the ICU to see her? And she said, well, it's a cardiac ICU. To have a baby in here? And he said, you don't understand. I know my wife, and she has to have something to live for. And she said, yeah, okay. And he brought the baby in, and my dad stepped around that curtain, and he took that picture because he didn't know if it would be the last time that the three of us were together, because at that point, I was doing awful. And I think that picture captures the raw emotion of my story and of what I've been through and about the long walk better than any other picture I have. Because in that moment, he's looking at me like his quote over there. When I asked him, honey, what was the hardest part beginning to end for you? He said, it's like they were mechanics and you were a machine, and I couldn't make them see that you were more than that. You were my wife. And he said at the beginning they were coming and going and trying this and trying that and trying this and trying that. And they would say, oh, this will make it better, that'll make it. And no one just stopped and said, I am so sorry you are walking through this. I am so sorry this is happening. These are your options. And laid it out. He felt like they were working on a car. And they were working on his whole life right there, right? Please make sure that you know. Yeah. Are you a technician or a teacher? You're both. You are a technician. You have a scientific background. You can move the needle in research. You have an incredible mind if you are sitting in this room today. That's how you got here. But you're a teacher too. Medicine is where science meets the humanities. Medicine is where science meets humanity. And it's your job to make sure that you're as much a teacher as you are a technician, and that you embrace that role, not just locally, but beyond that, if you so choose. And why? Because we get moments because of that. When people say, why do you do this work? Or why does this matter to you? Or why should I make my life even more difficult? I'm already overwhelmed. I already have to document this. I already have so much paperwork. And now you want me to have a conversation? Right? Because that appointment, that oxygen concentrator, those meds, when my primary care physician is the one who told me, hey, we have to move you to another surgeon. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. She's the one that did that. She gave me my moments, right? Without them, I wouldn't have them. We talk about, oh, people live because of you. But what does it mean to live? It means that I got to dance with my daddy, and I got to see my son grow up to 9 years old now, and I got to dress up like Lois Lane when he was Superman, and I got to see my friends rally around me, and I just watched my niece get married recently, and then I get to hold their little babies. I get to live my life and have those moments and touch people as you've touched me. And it spreads. So when you think of the challenge set before you, think of the moments that are at stake. You won't have to ask yourself then, is it worth it? It's worth it. Thank you.